Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abadi, and coming up, the skies wide open as Europe's largest telescope, GREGOR, goes online.
There are so many physics questions, and I think everybody will be excited to really see the sun at the finest spatial scales. I don't even know what we will discover.
Also on the program, scientists in the US sequence the DNA of a human fetus still in the womb. And a breakthrough in opium research could lead to new treatments for tumours and cancer cells. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, there's not a lot which happens up in space that we can see down here on Earth. Certainly not with the naked eye anyway. You may of course have been lucky enough to catch the transit of Venus last week. But other than that, space events have to be truly massive for us to see them down here. Like some of the bigger solar flares, for instance. Even with those large events, though, it's still pretty hard to make out any detail. That is, it has been until now, because Europe's largest solar telescope, GREGOR, has just come online on Tenerife, and it promises to offer some of the clearest and most detailed images yet. Daniel Bishton visited the Leibniz Institute for Astrophysics in Potsdam, which will help maintain the data pipeline from Tenerife and pass it on to other institutes around the world.
GREGOR is Europe's newest and largest solar telescope and is located on Tenerife in the Canary Islands. GREGOR's design represents a new generation of solar telescopes and has the potential to drastically improve our understanding of solar formations.
Okay, we are right now in the old Berlin Observatory, and we always would like to see what's going on at Tenerife.
Here at the Leibniz Institute for Astrophysics, Professor Carsten Denker says its technology will allow scientists to see complex formations in great detail.
Previously, telescopes were built as vacuum telescopes. That means you had a big window, 1 meter, for example, and inside the telescope tube you had a vacuum, so to avoid turbulence inside the telescope. Now, we wanted to build a bigger telescope. There are two reasons for that, to collect more light and to resolve finer structures on the sun. But if you do that, these vacuum windows get just too big, so you have to build 30, 40 centimeter thick windows and glass of that thickness you cannot look through any longer.
GREGOR features a 1.5 meter primary mirror, making it the largest solar telescope in Europe and the third largest worldwide. Named after 17th century Scottish mathematician and astronomer James Gregory, who pioneered the Gregorian telescope, GREGOR uses an advanced adaptive optics system and an open design to deal with the significant challenges of observing the sun through such a large aperture.
The basic principle is called an open design. So you don't have vacuum windows, you have a big mirror and an open telescope structure, and you use the wind flow to cool the telescope structure, but also to blow gently over the surface of the primary mirror. And for that, you have to build a fairly stiff telescope. The wind has to be fast enough that all the turbulence will be blown away, but the telescope has to be stiff enough that at wind speeds up to 20 meters per second, which is a substantial wind speed, nothing is shaking, because that would deteriorate your image quality.
Professor Denker's primary field of research is in the interaction of magnetic fields on the sun's photosphere, its visible surface. Areas of concentrated magnetic interaction create sunspots, which in turn cause solar flares and coronal mass ejections, or CMEs. Ejecting matter and electromagnetic radiation through space at the speed of light, CMEs can destroy satellites and even threaten the lives of astronauts at the International Space Station.
And once a while it happens that shear motions basically drags the field lines, the magnetic field lines, with them. And so you can have something that we call a short circuit in the magnetic field. So the technical term is magnetic reconnection. And what happens during magnetic reconnection is that the energy stored in the magnetic field is suddenly released and the magnetic field lines snap back like a rubber band into a more simple configuration. And this is one of these flares.
GREGOR's high spatial resolution will offer scientists a new understanding of the interaction of flow fields, convection, and magnetic fields on the sun's surface. It's hoped Gregor will help scientists predict solar flares and other hazardous solar events.
For that, you really have to understand how magnetic fields do magnetic reconnection. So for that, I think Gregor can actually make a big contribution, because we really see in very good detail how magnetic fields interact with each other. And once we figure out, okay, what are the signatures of this type of interaction, then we can go ahead and say to our colleagues which operate, for example, satellites, here, look at this feature. When that happens, maybe an hour later, you will have a flare.
Gregor's progress will be watched closely around the world and is already considered a prototype for a new generation of solar telescopes. Aspects of its optics and instrumentation will be used in the design of the European Solar Telescope, which will also be based in the Canary Islands, and in Hawaii, for the Advanced Technology Solar Telescope, or ATST, which is due to be completed by 2019. Dr. Thomas Rommel, Project Director of the ATST in New Mexico, says he and others are keen to learn from Gregor.
ATST is for a coronal telescope, so it wants to observe the corona. Gregor doesn't do that. But everything following the main telescope, instrumentation, adaptive optics in particular, there we share our common designs. But also the technology interests me, of course, a lot, and I would like to learn from that how to apply this technology to the ATST.
Back in Potsdam, Professor Denker has begun the painstaking task of tweaking Gregor's instruments with real data. His excitement is contagious.
I think for us, the first big milestone would be to get one really exciting data set. And after that, there are so many physics questions. Many people will look at these data and many people will be excited about different aspects. And I think everybody will be excited to really see the sun at the finest spatial scales. I don't even know what we will discover.
Dr. Carsten Denker ending that report there by Daniel Bishton in Potsdam. Well, scientists at the University of Washington say they've sequenced the DNA of a human fetus in the womb, giving them a much clearer view of subtle variations in the fetus's genome than was possible before. The scientists used only a blood sample from the mother and saliva from the father. And the test was so successful, they now say they can get a more precise reading of a group of 3,000 single gene disorders called Mendelian disorders, which include things like cystic fibrosis and one form of Alzheimer's disease. The most impressive thing here is the fact that the test was non-invasive and with it a lot safer than current tests for things like Down syndrome, which can result in the loss of the baby. I spoke to one of the researchers on the project, Dr. J. Chinjure.
So we attempted to reconstruct the complete genome sequence of a human fetus using samples obtained non-invasively from the mother and the father in the second trimester of the mother's pregnancy. And so more specifically, we used about 5 milliliters of blood from the mom and a spit sample from the dad. And, you know, as part of this to determine the genome, we took advantage of the fact that in the blood of a pregnant woman, in the cell-free compartment of the blood, what's called the plasma, it turns out that about 10% of the DNA that's free-floating in the blood actually comes from the fetus and not the mother. So through the combination of having the genome of the mother, the genome of the father, and by deeply sequencing this mixture of mostly mother's DNA but a little bit of child's DNA, and putting all that information together with some clever computational approaches, we were able to reconstruct the genome of the child with high accuracy.
And this is quite fascinating and quite groundbreaking, because it's done in a non-invasive manner. Because, of course, a lot of people who are expecting children, they feel they need to undergo invasive and quite dangerous tests.
There's a lot of anxiety and that goes into those decisions about how to balance the risks of an invasive test versus wanting to know more information.
Because
hopefully this takes some of the risk out of the equation.
Right, and we're talking about illnesses or conditions like Down syndrome, and you said that you can perhaps be able to detect about 3,000 single gene disorders.
Yeah, so there are existing technologies doing something like this that can already detect Down syndrome. But the analogy here is that, you know, if you think about the human genome as a book, Down syndrome is like having an extra copy of an entire chapter, right? So that's something that's easy to spot maybe from far away. However, what we're hoping to be able to do with this sort of method is to be able to detect typos in single words, let's say, in that book. And so it's the typos in the single words that usually underlie these thousands of other single gene or Mendelian disorders.
So you're talking about the clarity of the picture you're getting there, aren't you? Because I was trying to strengthen the idea that the current test and most precise test for Down syndrome is quite dangerous, isn't it? You can lose the baby if the test goes wrong. It doesn't often happen
in
most countries.
The invasive tests for Down syndrome are quite risky, right? So but they're also the tests for other genetic disorders are also, you know, the diagnostic tests are also invasive and can be risky in certain circumstances.
So just tell us a little bit more about the heightened clarity that you're getting here of the fetus's genetic makeup.
So you think about what the genome of the child is. It consists of both inherited variation, so variation that was inherited from either the mother or the father, as well as what we call de novo mutations, right? Mutations that are newly occurring in the genome of the child. And so what we were able to show is that we were able to predict inherited variation with about 98% accuracy. I think that could go up to above 99% with a little bit more work. And in addition, we were able to detect about 90% of those de novo mutations. There's still considerable work required to better figure out how to tell the signal from the noise in terms of picking up those new mutations, but we at least showed that it was possible, potentially, to do.
Of course, there are some people who say that the better the tests are, the more likely disorders are going to be picked up early on, and that could raise the rate of abortions, of unwanted children, so to speak. What do you say to people who have criticized your research and that they're saying that this could be dangerous from a pro-life stance?
So I don't think this what we have done doesn't fundamentally change any of the ethical challenges and debates that are out there. I think it maybe heightens our focus on them, but it doesn't really change the debate itself or any of the arguments. But I also think
it's important
in the same context as talking about terminations to remember that knowing, having this information at an earlier stage can also very realistically enable better prenatal care for the growing child, right? Having knowledge of these diseases and maybe in some cases even prenatal interventions or therapies. And then also in the immediate days after the child is born, having this knowledge in advance, well in advance, can potentially help with better postnatal care. So I think those are also things to remember when we sort of think about the consequences of this sort of technology.
Jay Shengere, Associate Professor of Genome Sciences at the University of Washington, speaking to me there on the line. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani on DW Online. We're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, always follow us at DW_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
When we think of laser printing, we still tend to think about black and white documents printed on paper, not three-dimensional objects. But just as modern printers revolutionised the office environment 20 years ago and the internet supercharged it, three-dimensional production methods, including computer-aided design tools and lasers, are causing a similar change in the field of mechanical engineering these days to bring us rapid manufacturing technology. It won't be long now before European designers are emailing print specifications for their products to customers anywhere in the world and having their products printed or materialized by the end user. Sonia Dean has this report by Fabian Schmidt.
Scanning objects or designing them on a computer and then printing them out in three dimensions. Although it sounds like science fiction, it's becoming established practice in research and industry these days. Even human bones or organs can be faithfully reproduced, as models at least. The technology is called rapid manufacturing, and it's allowing engineers, designers, and physicians to create real plastic or metal things out of data. Andreas Wegner, a polymer processing specialist at the University of Duisburg-Essen, describes how it works.
You start with a regular computer-aided design program, which sketches out the pieces in three dimensions. This gets loaded into the system software, where it's broken down into separate layers, and the equipment then produces the component, layer by layer.
These layers start off as wafer-thin bits of plastic or metal powder. Starting with the base plate, the layers are melted using lasers until they take a precise form. as Gerrit Witt, a manufacturing engineering professor with a Duisburg facility, explains.
Every time the laser fuses another layer, the base plate drops down 0.1 millimeter. Then another layer of powder is added and is spread as if with a snowplow. And the component takes shape as the plate keeps dropping.
As the base plate drops with each deposit, the completed object ends up consisting of thousands of layers from the bottom up. Any remaining powder falls off the item when it's removed from the printer. It's also cleaned and polished in a sandblasting facility. There's potential for doctors who can use three-dimensional images, such as CAT scans, to produce synthetic bones. Jan Zeat, head of the Duisburg Rapid Technology Center, loads data onto his computer to build an exact replica of the human cranium.
Here, for example, you can see the veins mirrored in the cranium and cerebral membrane.
An implant could be developed using this method, while the models could also be useful in helping surgeons prepare for operations. Jan Zeat again.
If it works on a plastic model, it'll work on a patient, and it means operating on and anesthetizing them one less time. It's better for the surgeon, too.
Dental prostheses are already being produced using the laser melting process. The root from a titanium alloy, the crown out of ceramic. As well as hard bone, soft organs can also be produced out of plastic and to scale. Zeat and his colleagues have even used magnetic resonance imaging data to produce a plastic heart that shows the fine branching of blood vessels, just as in a real heart. Originally, the laser melting technique was known as rapid prototyping because developers use it to make prototypes, for example, in the automobile industry. It's now called rapid manufacturing, but it's actually quite slow. It might take an hour to produce a plastic pen in a horizontal position. And if you wanted to produce the pen vertically, as if it were standing up or being held, it would take 10 times longer because you would need to print so many layers. Manufacturing with metal takes longer still, although it's also much more precise because the layers are so thin, says engineer Gerrit Witt.
Metal has less depth per layer, and that gives it a different texture. The layer thickness is only about 20 to 40 micrometers.
The components are just as durable as cast or forged metal, as the laser reaches a high enough temperature to create a strong bond between the layers. The technique has made it into regular industrial production. Components can be customized to the client's specifications, and it's also well-suited to production of small batches and spare, or even rare, components, which can be produced to order.
Sonia Dean with that report by Fabian Schmidt. Well, opium has been long used in medicine, both legally and illegally, by artists and scientists and, of course, pharmaceutical firms. Aside from being the source of the highly addictive drug heroin, opium poppies are used in the production of painkillers as well, like codeine and morphine, and also as a cough suppressant. And all types can be addictive. But scientists in the UK say they've now discovered how opium poppies produce a non-addictive compound made up of a cluster of 10 genes that's responsible for the synthesis of noscopine, and it could help in the development of drugs for the treatment of tumours and cancer cells. The findings could also massively expand the cultivation of opium poppies, moving production from the fields to the factories. I spoke to lead researcher Professor Ian Graham at York University.
The compound that we're interested in is called noscopine, which has been used, in fact, for decades as an anti-cough treatment and has been present in cough medicines. And then more recently, in the late 1990s, it was shown also to have anti-tumour, anti-cancer activities. And so it's currently in early-stage clinical trials.
For these new application areas, is what you're saying, the clinical trials?
Yes. For as an anti-cancer treatment, early stage trials. So it's not a drug yet, but it's in early stage trials. And in fact, noscopine production hasn't really increased in line with the other compounds such as morphine and codeine. In fact, the new plant varieties that have been developed for morphine and codeine, which are analgesics or painkillers. And so now with this breakthrough that we've just had, it allows us to do rapid plant breeding to develop the production system for noscopine as well.
So just to explain, you discovered a cluster of 10 genes. What's the exact significance of that?
It's significant in a number of ways. First, it's the most complex gene cluster so far described in plants. It's 10 genes which encode 5 different enzyme classes that are all involved in the biosynthetic pathway for production of noscapine. So in discovering this cluster of genes that have come together over evolutionary time, it's also provided us with the tools to define the biosynthetic pathway. So in this recent publication, we also described the outline of the biosynthetic pathway for noscapine production. And the significance then extends into the applied side as well, because we have a cluster of 10 genes. That means that in terms of plant breeding, we can cross them into other varieties quite easily, varieties which would have improved agronomic traits or other traits which make them more efficient for production of noscapine.
Well, you mentioned new application areas, say in perhaps hopefully in treating tumour cells, etc. But in terms of the production, you might be able to bring this closer into a factory or laboratory. Is there the chance that you might be able to do away with the crop at the heart of this and just focus on the noscapine?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I guess what happens in the real world often comes down to economics. And the simple fact is that plants are still very good factories for producing high-value chemicals. And, you know, the poppy plant itself is very efficient at producing opiates such as morphine and codeine. And indeed, you know, the world supply still comes from poppy plants that are grown in places like Tasmania and in Australia. And the same is true for noscapine. So it's possible that you could lift the pathway into bacteria or yeast cells and grow those in fermenters. But at the minute, you know, the plant-based system is efficient at production, and we're not actively following that route at the minute.
You conducted your study in collaboration with GlaxoSmithKline, one of the world's biggest pharmaceuticals companies. They produce all sorts of things, of course. Apart from their reaction, I'm sure they're pretty happy about this. Have you had any other reactions from other companies, other pharmaceutical companies? Is this something that they've been hanging out for, so to speak? I mean, because if Tasmania is producing 20% of the world's medicinal opiate needs, Tasmania is actually quite small, isn't it? Probably can't cope.
Yes, I think it's, you know, for various historic reasons, Australia was chosen for production, probably because it's quite isolated and easy to control the crops as well. GlaxoSmithKline produce in Australia. You know, other pharmaceutical companies also produce in Australia. So it's not just them that have a focus on Australia. I think there's quite a lot of land in Tasmania and in the rest of Australia as well that can be used for production. And there is European-based production of poppies as well. You know that there is some production, I think, in Spain and in Turkey. So there, you know, it's the legal commercial poppy business is quite active.
Professor Ian Graham, Director of the Centre for Novel Agricultural Products at York University, speaking to me there. Well, Berlin has to be one of the trendiest places on earth for the nightlife and for its creative, techie startup culture. Not for nothing have a heap of young and talented net-savvy people made names for themselves with projects like SoundCloud there. It's one of the reasons why thousands of Europeans and others are moving to Berlin every year. Many go there to study, of course. Not just for the party. Berlin was recently ranked 8th in a British education survey, and among the capital city's institutions, it's above all Berlin's technical university that's attracting future engineers. Melanie Savchenko has been looking at life and study in Berlin.
I'm studying industrial engineering, yeah.
And why did you choose Berlin out of other places?
Actually, I chose Berlin because, you know, first of all, the city. Because, you know, I think right now is the most young and, you know, fast city in Europe. So I think it's perfect. It's a kind of city for the folks, I guess. About, you know, the Europe situation, I think Germany is the best place to be right now. That's it.
Marco is a young man who came from Italy for Erasmus, a European Union student exchange program. He'll be studying at the Technical University of Berlin for the next 6 months.
Right now, I try to compare the Italian life and the German life. I noticed that, you know, here the welfare is higher than Italy, you know. So, you know, people are richer and the price is low.
prices are indeed low in Berlin. So low, in fact, that every person I spoke with mentioned it at least once, usually in connection with cheap rent and cheap beer.
In Paris, if you have a room of 10 meters, you are lucky, and it's very expensive. And here for 300 or 200, you can have a big room in the big flat, so the food is less expensive too. Beer is less expensive. I think a lot of things is less expensive.
Thomas, like Marco, is also part of the Erasmus program. He just moved to Berlin a few weeks ago to study landscape design.
I think it's maybe one of the most international cities for students now in Europe. And all my friends say me, you are so lucky to go in Berlin because for young people it's very famous.
Olaf Roepke coordinates exchanges for overseas students at the Technical University. He says Berlin's attraction lies in its growing diversity.
Well, Berlin itself is so multicultural. There are so many different people from around the world living in the city. Every year there are more courses being held in English because there's an internationalization going on. And yeah, we want to be part of it, so we have to offer courses in English. Yeah, And there's a huge party scene, which is really important for students.
Cheap and party. Two words synonymous with Berlin, it seems. In surveys, Berlin gets top marks when it comes to a high quality of life and low living costs, especially in comparison to pricier European capitals like Paris and London, where students pay thousands more per year. It's just one more reason why so many students want to stay in the capital after their exchange program is over, says Olaf's colleague, Beatrice Vinci.
Even those students arriving in the winter semester for one semester realize, oh, I like here, it's like a paradise, and a lot of them want to stay for one more semester.
I meet student Max Tager in the cafeteria. He says Berlin's economic advantage has its downside, too.
The conditions of studying, like not just the living conditions, but the conditions just exceptionally at the university, they are worse compared to any other city. Because Berlin is a very, very poor city. They don't have like very good equipment. The auditoriums are always completely overfilled.
In addition to poor facilities, as Max points out, Berlin ranked low regarding reputation and interest from international employers who tended to give preference to students from elsewhere. So why did he decide to stay in his hometown instead of going abroad?
The field of business and engineering, the Technical University of Berlin is ranked fourth by employees. They like that we have a very international experience at the Technical University of Berlin. We're, I guess, the most international university in Germany because we got like 135 nations studying here.
But Olaf Roepke says sometimes students are better off returning to their home country after graduation.
The job market is really competitive because in Berlin there's a huge unemployment rate. And most of the students, they want to stay and do an internship. That usually works, but finding a steady job is really difficult.
Beatrice Vinci agrees.
And so it's a wave. You come here as an exchange student. You enjoy nightlife. It's very cheap to live here. But when you want to go further, then someday you will leave Berlin.
This is Melanie Savchenko for DW in Berlin.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. And listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. And we are, of course, at DW_SciTech if you need some entertaining at a bus stop during the week. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Our studio tech was Christoph Gruver. Coming up soon, the madness of maths and soccer on Spectrum. Until then, thanks for listening and bye for now.